got so many calls and comments, mostly critical of my views on the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and what happened in Boulder, Colorado, and Atlanta, Georgia, that I decided to devote the vast majority of today's Dirt Show to your views, to the wits. I want to hear what you have to say on the Dirt Show. Today on the Dirt Show, we're going to do something quite unusual. There was so much reaction to my take on the Second Amendment yesterday and my views on the Boulder shootings and the Atlanta shootings, so much controversy, that I decided just to do a short update on what's going on in Boulder and with advocacy of gun control, and then move right to the comments and the criticisms, because there are many. I want to make sure you have your say, because I have expressed views that I know are controversial among some of my listeners and viewers. I used to do this occasionally when I taught at Harvard Law School. If I gave an extremely controversial class and there wasn't really a full opportunity for all the students to get their views across, I would hold a special class in which there were only questions and only comments from the students. And those proved to be very interesting, intellectually, psychologically, and in every other way. So I decided to do the same thing today with calls and comments on the Second Amendment. Just a little bit of an update. Look, there was a lot of reaction yesterday to the Boulder shooting. President Biden called for, as you might expect, a more effective gun control, particularly semi-automatic weapons, the kind of weapon that was used in the Boulder killing. Former President Obama poignantly talked about how terrible it is in America that when you go shopping, you don't know whether it will be the last time you're alive, and how we have to make it safer. And he wasn't specific about the kind of gun control he wanted. This is not a partisan issue. This is an issue that crosses party lines. There are Democrats who oppose gun control. For example, Bernie Sanders, coming from Vermont, has long been an opponent of effective gun control. And there are some Republicans, particularly from urban areas, who support effective gun control. I think one of the most surprising reactions came from the New York Post, which is a mostly conservative, pro-Republican newspaper that generally can be counted on to take more conservative positions. It came out very strongly for gun control. It says this is not a matter of conservatives versus liberals or Republicans versus Democrats. It's a matter of life and death. And they think that patrol guns, the guns that are used by law enforcement, should not be allowed to be in the hands of ordinary citizens. Also, they support waiting periods and registration. We had a very, very good, I thought, interesting seminar on whether the Second Amendment would preclude those kinds of effective checks on the easy availability of guns. I read the Second Amendment as permitting regulation because of the structure of the amendment. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, again during the question and answer period. But, you know, you can debate, you can discuss all the empirical data. You know, people who are against gun control say the easy availability of guns is a deterrent to crime. Others say, no, it causes crime. Let the scientists continue to debate that issue. The one thing that seems crystal clear, and I would be interested in your comments on this, is the direct association between the easy availability of guns in the United States. We have more guns in the United States than any country in the world. We have more guns than people. And we also have more gun murders, more gun shootings, more gun killings, more gun woundings than any country in the history of the world. That cannot be a coincidence. The New York Post cites data suggesting that when New York tightened up on gun availability, murder went down, shootings went down. We know that in Boston, when they started seizing the guns of young gang members, perhaps compromising the Fourth Amendment in the process, we know that gun violence went down as well. So I think there's more than an association between easily available gun ownership and the number of gun crimes and the seriousness of gun crimes. And that's why I believe the Second Amendment does permit effective gun control and does permit regulation, which would preclude the sale of guns at gun fairs that are unregulated, at flea markets, require a waiting period, require that the person seeking the gun demonstrate no history of violence or a mental illness associated with violence, no history of threatening spouses, inter-family violence of any kind. So I know this is controversial, and I want to hear your views. I want to hear what you have to say. I want you to be able to be free to comment on this. I know there are many calls. I don't know the content of the calls. I know some are critical, but I haven't heard them. I'm going to hear them for the first time, just the way I would hear them for the first time in a class at Harvard Law School. So, bring it on. Let's hear your views on gun control, the Second Amendment, and the violence in Boulder and Atlanta.
I just wanted to talk about your discussion of the Second Amendment, which I think we agree says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, you point out that there are two plausible interpretations. You seem to think one is less plausible and yours is more plausible. One, the one that you attribute to the majority in the Heller decision, that they ignore one clause and they just say the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. You said, you know, when you read the amendment, clearly the first clause is the reason that's given for the second clause, which means that on your reading, the amendment means the reason that the people have a right to keep and bear arms is that this right is to be well regulated by a militia that is necessary to the security of a free state. I mean, that's one way of understanding what you said. But maybe it was something more like the reason that a well-regulated right of the people to keep and bear arms is that a militia is necessary to the security of a free state. In either case, I think that there's another way of understanding it and a better understanding, perhaps not suggested by the majority in the Heller decision, but that is that the reason that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed is that a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. And that is that we need to have well-regulated militia. That is, if you go back to revolutionary times, well-regulated versus irregular militias. And it seems to me that is what a caller the other day was trying to point out. And it seems to me that that's a better interpretation than or closer to what it means in English, at least, I'm no lawyer, than the ones that you suggest. Because I don't see how it suggests that the right to bear arms, to keep and bear arms, is modified by a government, by the militia at all. And I thought it was an ad hominem argument to say that the framers of the Constitution deserve D- for drafting the Second Amendment, basically because it fails to support the interpretation that you like for the Second Amendment, not the one that it seems they were writing.
I think the best proof that the framers of the Second Amendment deserve a D- is the fact that we have to be having this debate. There was a cartoon somebody recently sent me. It had the framers standing around writing the Constitution. And one of them says to the other, hey, just to be funny, why don't we make the decision about what's constitutional, unconstitutional, a little squishy so people in the future will have trouble with it? I think they did that with some amendments quite deliberately. When they talk about equal protection of the law, due process, cruel and unusual punishment, those are squishy. Those are intended to have content added over time. This is just bad draftsmanship. They could easily just have said, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Just the way it says in the Third Amendment, no soldier shall be, quartered. Just a direct, open statement. That's the way you draft rights. If you want them to be complete and thorough and stand on their own, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. They didn't do that. They gave a modification. They modified it. They gave an explanation which I think invites the argument that you should interpret the second clause by reference to the first clause. As I said, both are plausible interpretations. And when you have two plausible interpretations, it gives the courts the power to interpret them consistent with current and contemporary values. Now, even as the Heller majority acknowledged, the constitutional right to bear arms historically was the right to bear the kinds of arms that were ordinarily possessed by citizens. At the time of the Constitution, obviously, they were single-shot rifles. I don't even think the pistol had been invented. There were certain, obviously, dueling pistols, but the Colt 45 and other things of that come later. So you can also, without regard to how I interpret the two clauses, say that the right to bear arms means the right to bear the kind of arms that the framers of the amendment had in mind. And it we don't know what the framers would have said about automatic or semi-automatic weapons. So that's now left to the popular branches of government, to the legislature, subject to the president's veto. And that's a fair interpretation as well. But I don't think one can look at the Second Amendment and say unequivocally, without any doubt, it doesn't permit regulation of guns, doesn't permit regulation of the right to bear arms. Even the majority in Heller did acknowledge that some degree of regulation is permissible, and how much and of what kind is always going to be a matter of interpretation and a matter of degree. So let's agree that there are multiple plausible interpretations. I think that's undoubtedly the case, because otherwise we just would have had a directive, the right to bear arms, and we don't have that. And then the question is, who gets to interpret? Is it up to the states? Is it up to the Supreme Court? And we can continue to debate about that very, very complex jurisprudential issue. But thank you so much for your very intelligent call.
Hello, Professor Dershowitz. This is Lawrence from Georgia. And first, I'd like to thank you for your podcast. Learn something new every day, and I have paid my tuition. My question is on the Second Amendment, and I'm not making an argument for or against. But I see the Bill of Rights as my individual rights that the Founding Fathers were telling me that were God-given and couldn't be taken away. So my question is that, out of the individual rights, why did the Founding Fathers put the Second Amendment at number two? Why was it even in the Bill of Rights if it's a group right? If it's not my individual right, why is it? Why did they put it at number two?
It's a very good question, and it is number two. Actually, it was originally number five. I don't know how many of you know that the original Bill of Rights had 12 amendments, and two of them were rejected by the states. They had more to do with compensation of legislatures and other matters, and the Bill of Rights ultimately came down to 10 amendments, the first being free speech and freedom of expression and religion. And the second, yes, number two, you're absolutely right. It's before number four. But look at number three. Number three is an amendment that's never been used. It was so completely time-bound. No soldier shall in times of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. What is that doing in a Bill of Rights? I mean, obviously, we saw the British quartered their troops in the homes of American colonial patriots, and they were upset about that. And it's in the bill, it's in the Declaration of Independence as well. And so they put it as number three. That doesn't mean it's more important than the Fifth Amendment or the Eighth Amendment. And then if you look at the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, they don't seem to deal specifically with individual rights. They deal much more generally with how you approach the Bill of Rights. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by them to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. That's an allocation of power. So, look, the Second Amendment is the Second Amendment, but it does have those two clauses, and they have to be interpreted in tandem. You can't just eliminate the first clause of the Second Amendment. If they wanted to eliminate it, the Committee on Draftsmanship or the framers could easily have just limited the Second Amendment to its second clause. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That would make it simple. That would make it clear. That would give them an A in draftsmanship instead of the D minus that I give them for draftsmanship. So because of the way they drafted it, the debate continues and we get great questions. On to the next call.
Holding the Second Amendment, I heard your little soliloquy about the well-regulated militia, and you seem to be kind of focused on a well-regulated militia, implying that somehow the government's supposed to be in charge in that department. Well, if you look at the entire Bill of Rights, what that you're looking there is limitations on government. It would be inconsistent. And if you've read Federalist Papers and you've read the various debates about the Second Amendment, you'll know that the intent of the framers has always been for the right of the people to keep and bear arms. So that's the part you kind of left out. That should be now shall not be infringed, and you left that out. And I always find it funny when liberals talk about the well-regulated militia, because especially constitutional people, because they seem to just want to forget about what the Constitution really was, and especially the amendments and how it puts such limitations on the government, what the government cannot do. So to then say that we leap over and that now a well-regulated militia means that the government's going to be involved somehow, it doesn't make any sense. And you also have to make the leap that for the past 250 years or so that we've gotten it wrong, that all along this was supposed to be about the National Guard, but we've somehow gotten it wrong and all these years, and now it's up to us with our newfangled way to read it, we're going to make the changes to it. So now, in America, we know the real deal. The real deal is America has, and Americans individually have the right to keep and bear arms to protect themselves and to protect our country. Anyway, thank you, and love the show. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thanks. A very, very interesting call. But let's go back to the history. Where you're mistaken is that the Bill of Rights doesn't regulate the government, doesn't control the government. It only controls the federal government. It says Congress shall make no law. There are provisions in the Constitution specifically that apply to the states. No state shall pass an ex post facto law or a bill of attainder. Every state is guaranteed a Republican form of government. But until the middle of the 20th century, certainly until the 14th Amendment was enacted in the middle of the 19th century, it never occurred to anybody that these restrictions apply to the states. Up until the 14th Amendment, and maybe really until the 1950s, the Second Amendment really said that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed by the federal government. The states had the right to infringe the right to bear arms. The states had that power. And when you look at the well-regulated militia, the well-regulated militia was state militias, not a federal militia. So if you're going to go back to the framers, you have to go back also to their intention to limit the power of the federal government vis-a-vis the state government. Let's look again at the 10th Amendment. The 10th Amendment. The power is not delegated to the United States, the federal government, by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it. To the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So there is a states' rights aspect. Remember Jefferson, Madison. Madison was the basic framer of the Constitution. He was a strong supporter of states' rights. Virginia was the sovereignty. The United States was the united part of bringing the states together. Hamilton, Washington took the opposing point of view. Great debates. I read the Federalist Papers. Obviously, I have a book introducing the Federalist Papers. You can get it on Amazon. I'm very familiar with the Federalist Papers. I read every word of the constitutional debates when I appeared in front of the Senate opposing President Trump's impeachment. So I pretty well know what the framers had in mind, and what they had in mind was restrictions on the federal government. Remember, too, Hamilton was not in favor of a Bill of Rights. If you look at the Federalist Papers, he opposes the Bill of Rights. He says they're dangerous because they suggest that maybe there are rights that are unenumerated, and if they're not in the Bill of Rights, then we don't have them. He took the view that we, the people, and the states, basically, had all the rights unless they were particularly proscribed or permitted by the Constitution. So, you know, there's a great, great seminar on jurisprudence and on federalism and on what the framers had in mind. But obviously, the dead hand of the law can't totally control how we deal with 21st century problems. And my view is that if the words of the Constitution permit flexibility, then that flexibility can incorporate current values. Look, you can't change 35 years to be president. You can't run for president and be president if you're 33, no matter how smart you are, no matter how mature you are. 35 is a cutoff, and it's right there in the Constitution. It doesn't say, for example, the need to have mature people as president of the United States being necessary to a free state, therefore the age of 35. It doesn't say that. If it said that, maybe you could argue, gee, maturity comes earlier. I think it probably comes later today than it used to come, but that's a debate that people can have. But that's not what 35 says. Absolute, clear, unequivocal. Whereas the Second Amendment has that other interpretation that's completely plausible, and that members of the Supreme Court over time, and even members of the Supreme Court in the Heller case, thought was plausible. The New York Post thinks it's plausible. I think it's plausible. Some of you don't. Let the debate continue.
Hi, Alan. This is Misha from North Carolina. I'm originally from the Soviet Union. And was a refusenik, so it took me 7 years to get out. So I want to talk about what you're calling gun control. First of all handguns today pretty much are semi-automatic. Everything is semi-automatic. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to protect your right for free speech, meaning the First Amendment, if you don't have guns? You cannot do it. You'd better have guns. What if you have, all of a sudden, your government becomes like rogue government? The country turns into Cuba, Venezuela, Soviet Union. You'll tell me, nah, it's not going to happen here. It can happen anywhere. You'd better have guns. Now, what do you do with what you said, mass shootings? First of all, if a person really have very strong intention, he or she will do it this way or that way. But against mass shootings, you know how when you get installed security system in your house, every installer will tell you, you really don't need a security system. All you need is a sign that you have a security system. Nobody wants to get into a house with a security system. My point is, make sure that people carry guns or promote gun ownership, promote concealed carry. If, let's say, the place where this shooter entered, I don't know, was like a supermarket or whatever, if there was a sign that the personnel in the supermarket are have guns, he wouldn't go there. Typically, people find soft targets. If you look at everything, nobody goes. Are there any shootings in or around, let's say, gun stores? No, no happens. Promote gun ownership. There's a little town in Georgia where everybody, if you live there, you're supposed to have guns. There's no crime. Who wants to do it? They're going to get killed. Anyway, that's my 2 cents. Yeah, more guns as opposed to less guns. That's the solution.
Interesting point, but I fundamentally disagree. You should know you come from the former Soviet Union. Yeah, the communists had guns, the Bolsheviks. and they took over from the Mensheviks and the people who wanted to have a peaceful democracy. And the end result was Stalin and Lenin and communism. So guns don't assure free speech. Guns don't assure the First Amendment. Guns assure tyranny. Castro had guns. He took over the government and repressed a free speech. The Iranian mullahs had guns, and they took over and repressed free speech. So I don't see that guns promote free speech. Guns promote resolving arguments by force rather than by dialogue. If you have a gun and you have your mouth and you're better at your gun than you are at arguing, you're likely to use your gun. You make a point about if every supermarket had a sign that said all of our people are armed, or if every school, every teacher was armed. There used to be a show called All in the Family, and they had Archie Bunker, who was this, you know, obviously a stereotype. And he gets and does an op-ed on television in which he says, if you required everybody who boarded an airplane to have a gun, there wouldn't be any hijackings. Well, you know, who knows? If everybody has a gun, there would be probably more gunfights in the OK Corral, more suicides, more inter-family disputes resolved by guns. Again, these are empirical issues that we can debate, but I would throw a question to my challenger. How do you explain the fact that we have more guns than any country in the world and more gun violence? You would think, under your theory, because we have more guns, we'd have less violence. But, you know, Japan has no gun violence. Great Britain used to have very little gun violence, now just a little bit more, but still not anywhere close to the United States. France has had gun violence. We saw what happened with Muslim extremists and others attacking magazines and attacking teachers. Of course, some were killed with machetes and knives. But I don't escape. You can't escape the correlation. Yes, I use the word correlation, not just association, between the easy availability of guns in the United States and the number of acts of gun violence in the United States. So I just fundamentally disagree with your point, and I certainly disagree with your point that you can't have a First Amendment without having a Second Amendment. Many countries in the world have the equivalent of a First Amendment. Canada has it, doesn't have a Second Amendment. Many other European countries with constitutions have freedom of speech and don't have freedom to carry guns. So I think the burden of proof is on you to demonstrate that the availability of guns is essential to promote the First Amendment. I just don't think that's correct, but you're entitled to your view, and the First Amendment protects your view with or without the Second Amendment.
Hi, Professor Dershowitz. This is Brett from Cleveland. You mentioned that many people choose one half of the Second Amendment, ignore the other half when arguing it. That's been my experience as well, but I'd like to explain my stance on why you must be very careful when using the preamble to the Second Amendment to modify the right of the Second Amendment. You compared the Fourth Amendment to the Second Amendment in your presentation. I'm going to do the same. I see the Second and Fourth similarly structured in that they both state a need in the preamble and then state that solution to that need in the form of a right. The problem with modifying the right based upon the need or preamble is that we could fill the need to modify the right. The Second Amendment is probably the best example, as we now have a standing army. Now that we have a standing army, has our need to protect the state been met? Do we no longer need a militia and therefore no longer need the right to bear arms? Can a right be circumvented by fulfilling the need of that right in a way that would render the right irrelevant? If we treat the preamble to the Fourth Amendment like we treat the preamble to the Second Amendment, then we could conceivably see our right to be free from unreasonable searches modified or removed because the government may conclude that our right to secure our persons, houses, papers, and effects has been fulfilled in some other way in which has been determined that the unreasonable searches no longer violate the need for the right against unreasonable searches. This is the kind of scenario we come to when we give equal weight to the preamble as we do to the actual right. I think we should take every word into consideration when we read the Constitution, but I want to explain why I believe that the text of the right itself should carry much more weight than the stated need for that right when interpreting the Constitution. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks.
That's a really excellent point of view, and I agree with you. I think the substantive right is more important than the reason for the right. I agree with that, but I don't want to ignore the reason for the right. But I'll take on your hypothetical directly. Now that we have a standing army, and we really don't have militias, we do have the National Guard, but the National Guard is subject to being nationalized. We do have, obviously, state police and other state units of effective control, but you know, one could make the argument, I would not make that argument, one could make the argument that now that we don't have well-regulated militias, we don't need well-regulated militias, because the Hamiltonians won the debate over the Jeffersonians and we have a standing army, maybe the Second Amendment doesn't really have the importance that it had at the time of the framing. Your analysis of the Fourth Amendment, I can't imagine that we would ever be able to secure the right of the people, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, or papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. By the way, that preamble also contains a right, unlike the preamble to the Second Amendment. It contains a right. It says the right shall not be violated. The right of the people shall not be violated. So that is the statement of an affirmative direct right. But I agree with you that you look at the specific right and give it more weight than you give the reason. But that doesn't mean you don't give some weight to the reason in interpreting the scope of the right. And that's all I'm saying. All I'm saying is that it was inconceivable to the framers to allow guns in contexts that were not well regulated. The guns were allowed in the context of a well-regulated right, the right of the states to have a militia. And I don't think it's a leap to then say that in light of the ambiguity of the Second Amendment, it is constitutional for the states and for the federal government, but certainly for the states, to well-regulate the ownership of guns, whether in the name of a militia or in the name of self-defense. Where I think we have the real dispute is what the previous caller talked about. Is there a right in the Second Amendment to use guns to overthrow the government? Very hard to imagine a constitution that contained the right to overthrow the government by force. Jefferson talked about it, but you know, Jefferson was in Paris when the Constitution was drafted, although he was back, I think, in the United States when the Bill of Rights were amended. You know, I'm a collector. I own a copy of the original book of congressional laws in which the Bill of Rights were ratified. And it has the votes of all the states, and it has the original 12 amendments. I treasure that, obviously. As somebody who believes strongly in the Bill of Rights, you might notice the tie I'm wearing tonight also. The tie says the Bill of Rights. So I'm not one who's going to easily compromise the Bill of Rights. But I think, as John Marshall said, the fourth Chief Justice of the United States, it is a constitution we're expounding, and a constitution that's supposed to last forever. And the reason ours is the most enduring constitution in the history of humankind is because we have construed it and interpreted it, not as a suicide pact, but as an ability to govern. And if we take away the right of the states and the federal government to do any regulation of guns, automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons, we will be, in my view, turning the Constitution into a suicide pact, which is why I want to see reasonable regulation of guns in an effort to prevent the tragedies that have occurred repeatedly in this country at schools, at movie theaters, at shopping malls, at supermarkets, at spas, and elsewhere. Again, I want to hear your views on this, so let's turn to our next call.
Hello, Alan. This is Andrew calling from Connecticut. Wow, I'm really enjoying your Second Amendment presentation. I imagine I'm not the only one. I'm probably one of hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are responding in protest to your Second Amendment interpretation, which, in my opinion, is there as a last resort if the conflict of powers between the, legislative and executive, and powers don't resolve themselves well. You can always go to war with the government with a parity of force. So that's the key thing. The government has tanks. The public should have tanks. If the government has semi-auto rifles, the people should have semi-auto rifles, so that it's a fair fight if it goes that far. No one wants that. No one asks for that. No one wishes that. But look at the environment we're in right now. You can't even ask the question, what happened in the election? You can't even ask the question, what's going on? They shut you down in terms of your ability to communicate, ability to protest, ability to ask questions. So, yeah, we're close. We're close. There's only so many slaps in the face before people will say, I think I've had enough of this. So anyway, love the show. I think you're off target, but on intent, in terms of your intentions, you mean well, but you're off target on this one because of the concept of disparity of force. Anyway, keep doing what you're doing. Keep publishing. I'm listening. It's wonderful. All the best. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks. I appreciate your commendations on my show, but I do have to respectfully disagree. Let's take your argument to its logical conclusion, parity of force. That means every time that Congress votes for a military budget, it should allocate the same amount of money and the same number of military resources to who? To you, to Proud Boys, to the Ku Klux Klan. Who gets the guns? Who gets to have a parity of force? And as you know, the United States, no secret, we have the largest nuclear weapon capacity in the world. We have bombs capable of destroying the world by the press of a button. Your parity argument would allow dissident groups to own nuclear weapons and use them against the government if the government had nuclear weapons. Maybe you would limit it just to weapons used domestically. Obviously, no country would ever use a nuclear weapon domestically. Well, not the United States. Iran, who knows how they would use their weapons. We see Syria use chemical weapons against its own citizens, against Kurdish citizens, against citizens who are not part of the support for the government. So the parity of arms argument is certainly not in the Constitution, and it's not in the debates over the Second Amendment, as far as I can recall them. If you can find anything in the debates, I'd be happy to keep an open mind about it. But I think the parity argument takes you to an illogical conclusion that really undercuts that view of the Second Amendment. I think the Second Amendment did recognize that people in the United States at the time of the enactment of the Bill of Rights had hunting rifles, had rifles for defense against marauding enemies, against individual criminals. But to extend it to a parity of arms between the government, which is voted for by the people, and individual groups. And it also raises the question, who gets the parity? Who gets the guns? Who gets the equal number of guns? You say the people, but the people include the Ku Klux Klan. The people include the Nazi Party. The people, obviously, in the former Soviet Union before the Bolshevik Revolution took over from the more democratic earlier revolutions that occurred in 1917, etc. They used their guns for tyranny. The French used their guns during the French Revolution and their guillotines to promote tyranny. The very word terrorism comes from the terror of the French Revolution. So obviously, having guns in the hands of people who want to overthrow the government is very dangerous. And I doubt the framers of the Constitution had that in mind. I think it was Hannah Arendt who once said, the easiest way to turn a revolutionary into a conservative is give them the right to govern. And once they have the right to govern, they don't want to see the right to revolution incorporated in the governing doctrines. That's why the Declaration of Independence is a radical document, and the Constitution of the United States is a conservative document. It's a document for governance, not a document for revolution.
Regarding the Second Amendment, I don't understand the confusion. If you just read it, meaning seems to be written on the page, right? A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, the first part, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, is a dependent clause, and it's totally irrelevant. It really just provides some additional information stating a well-regulated militia is necessary for a secure state. If you combine it with the independent clause, it gives a complete message that the right of the people to keep and bear arms not being infringed is a requirement to have a well-regulated militia. The sentence structure is a little odd, probably on account of the time it was written, but I mean, the dependent clause really just provides additional unnecessary information. The rule is that the right shall not be infringed.
Mm-hmm. So you agree with me the drafters get a D minus. You're saying that the initial clause was unnecessary. Why put it in? It's the joke, you know, let's muddle the Constitution so that the future people will be having the kind of debates we're having now on this show. I went to a Bible school when I was a kid. I studied in yeshiva and we studied the Torah, the Bible. And the first rule you learned in the Bible was there no unnecessary words. And so, for example, the Jewish Bible in the book of Deuteronomy in the portion called Judges uses the Hebrew word tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. And the interpretation is justice, justice must you pursue. And it repeats the word justice. And all the scholars say, why is the word justice repeated? And, you know, the answer is it wasn't just for clarity or it wasn't just for emphasis. There must be a reason why the writer of the Torah, God, the Moses, who knows, put in the words justice, justice. And it's led to hundreds of wonderful interpretations, you know, procedural justice versus substantive justice, justice for the victims, justice for the perpetrator, you know, justice in the short term, justice in the long term. There are so many interpretations, but nobody says that the use of the word justice, justice is simply redundant. And I think you have to say the same thing about the Constitution. They worked very hard on formulating the words of the Constitution. And if they just wanted to have the second clause, the right of the people, they would have done it. So it's not unnecessary. It's there for a purpose. And I told you what I thought the purpose was, that there was a debate about whether the state should have the right to have a standing militia. And the compromise was, yes, a well-regulated militia being essential, etc. Then the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. So again, multiple plausible interpretations. That's why we have a First Amendment, so we can debate this. And if anybody ever tried to shut down this debate, I would do everything in my power to stop it. So let the debate go on. Let's turn to our next caller.
Hi, Professor. Regarding the Second Amendment, I think you described the words well-regulated as a condition to the right to bear arms. These words are in the preamble. Isn't the preamble simply an example as to why it's important to enumerate this right? If the preamble were a condition, wouldn't it completely restrict the right to bear arms for anything else but a militia? Thanks.
Well, good. There are those who take that view. I don't take that view. There are those who take the view that the only reason for the Second Amendment is to permit states to have a militia. I think if that were the case, you would only have the first clause. You would say a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the states to have a militia shall not be abridged. So I don't think that you can argue reasonably that the only purpose of the Second Amendment is to permit a militia. That could have been done easily with B-minus draftsmanship instead of D-minus draftsmanship. But you have two clauses, and they are part of the same sentence. They're not separated. It's not like the preamble to the Constitution, which is completely separate. And people don't read the preamble as conditioning the rights in the Constitution. But here it's part of the same sentence. And so what I do is I simply say that, look, when they discuss guns in the Second Amendment, which is something very rare in amendments, they made sure to use a term like well-regulated, that the militia can't just be a bunch of people who hang out in the corner general store and pick up guns and act as a militia. It has to be a well-regulated militia to be protected by the Constitution. And so I think one can interpret the right to bear arms as being modified by well-regulated. I agree that there is a plausible reading that doesn't modify the right to bear arms by well-regulated, but I think there is a plausible reading the other way as well, and that when you have two plausible readings, you interpret the Constitution in the light of current needs, and current needs are to have well-regulated gun control in this country.
Yes, Mr. Dershowitz, this is Matthew. I'm from Texas, and I understand your interpretation is a little different on mine on the Second Amendment, but I think it's pretty clear the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's clearly stated. It talks about a well-regulated militia, but it clearly states the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I'm wondering what your interpretation of people are, because I look at people as all people. We are all people. Thank you, and I appreciate your show and look forward to your comment.
You're absolutely right. The people means all the people. The people gives rights to individual people, and if you have any doubt about that, again, look at the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution. And that is, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So the people is used. It's also used in the 10th Amendment, the states respectively, or the people. So you're absolutely right. The Second Amendment gives that right to the people. Which people? Well, people who obey the law. It doesn't give that right to the Ku Klux Klan to use it in its lynchings. It doesn't give that right to the Communist Party to overthrow our government by force and violence. It doesn't give that right to the mafia or to cartels to use guns to bring about a horrible violence. And it doesn't give that right to the person who shot up the supermarket or the person who shot up the spa. They have no right to have guns. Their guns should never have been given to them under any reasonable approach to well regulation. And I do think that the idea of you can't infringe a right, you also can't abridge the right under the First Amendment. That doesn't mean that there is unlimited, unrestricted right of expression under the First Amendment. We know that there are restrictions. Incitement to imminent violence is not an abridgment of the right of free speech. Allowing some defamation claims is not an infringement of the right of free speech. Requiring waiting periods and registration is not, in my mind, the right, abridging the right or infringing the right to own guns. It is a right subject to regulation. And the regulation is akin to the regulations that apply to militias. Not everybody qualifies to be in a militia. If you have a history of violence and mental illness and abuse and criminality, nobody's going to let you in a militia. Because a well-regulated militia means regulating the kinds of people who get access to guns. So I interpreted the Second Amendment holistically. I look at it as a totality, and that's my interpretation. I know my views are minority views among my viewers and my listeners, and you'll see I didn't know what the content of the calls was. I knew that many of them were critical. Every single one of them was critical. And I welcome that. I want to have a debate. I would love to have a live podcast call-in show where we can have real-time debates. That's not really feasible, but this is second best. Let's regard this as the beginning of a dialogue. More of you, I know, would like to call in. So please call in. Give me your views, whichever side you're on, or if you're in the middle, give me your views on the Second Amendment, on the right to bear arms, on what's going on in places all over the country where we have mass killings. We have to address this problem, and we're going to continue to address it on The Dirt Show. An important part of The Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.